This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. If you were in a cult, how would you know? Turns out it's a lot harder than you might think. A listener named Linda learned that firsthand.
People ask, why would I join a cult? Of course, it was never presented as a cult. I was invited to fun events on campus and to meetings that were about topics that mattered to me. And I was invited by lovely people who were dynamic and had purpose in their lives, and I wanted that. You gradually get drawn in, you develop relationships, and eventually you start realizing that the message that's being presented to you is getting in your brain, and there's so much fear and exclusivity, you're pulled away from life and you can't get out.
We received a lot of voicemails like Linda's, far more than we expected. Cults often evoke images from the 60s and 70s, Charles Manson, Jonestown, and the like. But those in the know say cults are very much still a thing. Keith Raniere is the co-founder and leader of Nexium, an alleged sex cult and pyramid scheme. He was convicted this year of sex trafficking and racketeering. He's awaiting sentencing next year. This hour, we'll talk about what makes a cult, but let's start with a guest with some firsthand experience. Sarah Edmondson is an actress and author of the book Scarred. She was a member of Nexium for 12 years. Sarah, welcome to 1A.
Thank you so much for having me.
Talk about what your life was like when you encountered Nexium. Were things going well? Were they going poorly? Was it just kind of so-so?
Well, I was at the stage in my life where I was an aspiring actress, technically working but not really feeling fulfilled in my life, wanting more meaning, more purpose. And I encountered a recruiter from Nexium just at that right time where I was yearning for more.
Elaborate on meaning, purpose, that yearning. What were you yearning for?
Well, I'd always been raised by very grounded, politically and socially active parents who always taught me the importance of doing good in the world and making a difference. And I really didn't feel like my acting career was, providing that. And wanting to have a more fulfilled life, it just wasn't, acting wasn't that thing for me at that time. And Nexium landed in my lap just at the perfect moment.
What was that moment?
I was actually attending a film festival with my boyfriend at the time, who was a filmmaker, and we met the director of a film called What the Bleep Do We Know? I don't know if you ever saw that film.
Heard of it.
Yeah. At the time, it was very groundbreaking, and everyone was talking about it and had a lot of buzz, and it was really a film that was attempting to shift consciousness through media, and that totally appealed to me. And I met Mark, and he met us and invited us to come take a five-day seminar with other like-minded humanitarians, which totally appealed to all of my values, which I now understand is one of the hooks for getting people into cults.
Tell us about Mark. What was he like?
Mark at the time was this very cool filmmaker who was making films that were progressive, and I really respected him. He was kind of a typical Hollywood guy, and took us under his wing, and I really felt like I connected with somebody who was doing things in the world that I wanted to be a part of and work with him. So it was a great fit.
And just to be clear, you mentioned the movie What the Bleep Do We Know. Mark was not involved in that movie. He was a filmmaker, but not that film, right?
No, he made that film.
Gotcha.
He was the director of that film. So I definitely looked up to him and respected him and trusted him, and he also had good intentions, I believe, at the time, having just been recruited into Nexium and didn't know what it was all about, was inviting us to join him in this mission.
How did he describe Nexium to you? What was it about his description, his explanation of Nexium that hooked you?
The way he described it that I remember that moved me the most is that it was a community of people who were using their time and their resources and their connections to really impact the world, real humanitarians. He did mention Keith in that he was one of the smartest men in the world, which I don't think really hooked me so much at the time, but I remember thinking, wow, here's this intelligent man and this community of people who are striving to really impact the world.
Now, how did Nexium connect? Did they have, like, regular meetings? Was it an online chat? What was it?
There's a couple different things. It was a community in different cities, but to take a NXIVM training would be called Executive Success Programs, or ESP. And that is offered in different, or that program was offered in different cities. And it just happened just a few weeks after I met Mark, some people were producing one of these five-day weekends in my hometown of Vancouver, which had never been done before. And I thought that was the universe saying, here you go. I was at a point in my life where I wanted change, and here it was being presented to me. So I, you know, perhaps naively jumped on board without researching, trusting Mark, and took a five-day training, which was at that point the only thing that I could have done with ESP unless I went to another city like New York
and
or
Albany. And after you came out of that five-day training, what was different?
Well, I had a lot of shifts in that first 5 day. I felt so much more clarity in my life. I had been struggling with a lot of anxiety, which dissipated. I was taking sleeping pills to help me with that, and I didn't need to anymore. I was communicating better with people. I wasn't taking things personally and in interpersonal dynamics. I wasn't reacting to stuff that normally would trigger me. I felt just elated. I felt quite on fire, which I now know is another technique used by cults, is to create a state that's really almost euphoric in the initial stages. And that state is the drive for making you want more, more and more and more. And then there's sort of almost a chasing the dragon effect after that point.
Can you look back in retrospect and point to what it was about that event that caused that euphoria, that caused that sense of clarity?
Absolutely. ESP and NXIVM used psychological techniques, all stolen from other, I now know, stolen from other modalities, cognitive behavioral therapy, NLP, hypnosis.
I'm sorry, NLP, neuro-linguistic programming.
Sorry, yes, neuro-linguistic programming, which are modalities in their own right. And Keith cobbled these things together to create a five-day training where at the end of it, or at least for me, I felt like I had unhooked or unraveled a lot of my programming, and this isn't necessarily cult speak. I do believe this exists in the therapeutic world where you can have a reaction to something, bring it to your therapist and work on it, and then you no longer react to that thing, which is great, you know, if you want to work on that. And I think that what they pinpointed was very specific behavioral dynamics for each person individually. And when you leave the 5 day, if those things aren't bothering you anymore, say somebody doing something in your life that's a real challenge for you, that's no longer a trigger, that can be very freeing. And I had a lot of those. I had a lot of shifts around my beliefs and my fears around myself, my confidence. All of those things left me feeling like, wow, this is amazing. I want everybody to do this.
We're speaking to Sarah Edmondson, the author of Scarred, How I Escaped NXIVM, the Cult That Bound My Life. Sarah, at what point did your involvement in NXIVM start to get a little bit more serious, to the point that it might, in retrospect, start to look a little cult-like?
Well, in retrospect, the whole thing was cult-like from the beginning. Especially with the 5 day, certain elements like having us wear sashes or bow to Keith, who they asked us to call Vanguard. In retrospect, that's very culty, and I think
don't blaze past that. What were these sashes they made you? And I swear, yeah. I'm not trying to make light of this. I know this is very serious.
No, it's fine.
The sashes? What were these sashes?
So they had us wearing these maybe 4 inches across, different colored sashes that would go around your neck. And when you were a student, you wore a white one. And then when you graduated to coach, you wore a yellow one. And when you graduated to a senior coach, known as a proctor, orange, and then green, blue, purple, so forth. And of course, for any, I think, normal person, that would be weird. And as I did on day one, I said, I don't like this. I came for a personal development workshop. Why am I wearing this tacky satin's sash? And the thing that's important for people to know in terms of understanding cults is that the very first thing they did with us is that they said, if you're uncomfortable in this program, if you feel what we call the urge to bolt, that's great. It means you're doing it right. And there's an issue there, and we're going to work on it here. So if you agree to that, which I did, because I'm uncomfortable with this concept of sashes, it means that I have an issue. And if I leave, I'm not going to work on that issue. So I stick it through to address this so-called issue.
And how did you feel about calling Keith Raniere Vanguard and bowing to him?
Great question. I did not like it. I thought Vanguard was very strange. I did not like to bow to somebody I'd never met. I thought that was also very weird. And every single objection I had was met with a very reasonable answer, such as with calling Keith Vanguard, they'd say, well, you know, if you went to a courtroom, you'd call the judge Your Honor. It's just a formality. It's a tribute to what the person has built. And over time, you'll come to recognize what that is, and you'll feel okay with it. I said, okay. And all the while, every challenge I had with the training, I called Mark Vicente, and he said, just wait till day three, and see how you feel. Don't judge it yet. Wait till day three. And by day three, I'd had enough shifts in myself through the therapeutic modalities they provided that I felt, okay, you know, this Vanguard has done a good job here. I'll bow to him. Fine.
I want to learn more, Sarah, about the moment at which the cult kind of hooked you, as it were, when the journey began to go a little further south, as we continue our conversation with Sarah Edmondson. Glad to have gotten some of your comments, too. Bailey tweeted, I've always been interested in cults, and I have a vast knowledge of Jim Jones and the People's Temple. The idea started off great, but ended in chaos and death. We'll add a few more voices to our conversation and get at why cults fascinate us, more about how different kinds of cults work, and what people can do to escape them, and what happens to those who can't. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We are discussing cults with actress Sarah Edmondson, the author of the book Scarred, How I Escaped Nexium, the Cult That Bound My Life. Glad to get your questions, thoughts, and stories about your encounters with cults. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Sarah, I've got two more voices I want to add to our conversation, but just to continue with your story a bit, what was the moment where you finally were able to kind of say to yourself, I am in too deep. I am in a cult. Was there a moment that flipped that switch, or was it just a light bulb that went off over time?
Actually, Joshua, it was a couple of moments that happened in a very short period of time. There's a cult expert named Janja Lalić who talks about how we often, in abusive relationships like this, it's not one incident. It's something happens and you put that event on a shelf, metaphorically, and then something else happens and you put it on the shelf, and eventually the shelf breaks. So my shelf-breaking moment was after a series of things that happened that were just not okay but couldn't quite wake me up out of the Kool-Aid lull, as it were. So the first one would be somebody asking for the deed to my home as collateral to stay on the path of growth.
Wait, what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Lauren Salzman asked me to give me the deed to my condo in her name that she would hold as collateral to make sure I never got off the path.
And after you picked her up off the floor after punching her in the face, you said...
We weren't in the same city, but I was, at that point, supposed to be obedient to her. So I said, I'll get right on that.
And did you mean that?
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
I learned to be obedient to not get in trouble, is what I've now since learned about myself. I smiled and nodded and said, I'll get right on that, as I was trying to figure out how to get out. That happened, and then finding out through Mark Vicente, who ironically got me into Nexium and also helped me get out, we had a conversation where we basically compared notes about what we'd seen happening in Albany, where the, you know, proverbial mothership was located. And I don't live there, so I missed a lot of these things. And Mark had just left, and he shared with me what he knew, and I shared what I knew. And together, we put the pieces together to form the puzzle of what is now known as the quote-unquote sex cult that the media has been calling Nexium, which was not my experience, but is obviously what's been happening the whole time behind the scenes. And once we figured that out, and I realized that Keith was not who he said he was, in fact, that he was a sociopath, a narcissist, a con man, a sex addict, all these things came together all at the same time. And in addition, with looking at the scar on my body and realizing it was not a symbol for the elements, as I'd been told, but actually his initials in a monogram. And that was definitely my massive aha, WTF, I have to get out of this thing immediately.
Your scar, as I understand it, was from a brand that you got.
Correct.
Was it on your lower back?
I wish it was on my lower back. No, it is on my pelvic region, just in, under my bikini line.
And I'm hope was that the moment?
That was definitely the final moment. Let's put it that way. There was many moments leading up to it, and recognizing that Keith had purposely lied to me and gotten his henchwoman Lauren to put this symbol on my body and betrayed me in the worst way possible was for sure the moment.
I'm sure before we bring in our other guests, I'm sure there are some people who listen to your story and think this is an intelligent, articulate woman. So what the hell? Like, how does this get to the point where you are even contemplating sitting down with somebody and letting them put a hot brand on your skin for anything? And listen,
exactly.
I know that there are some fraternities who do branding. Mm-hmm. I know that there are some kinksters who do branding. So I'm not, I get it. I get it. Walk your walk. You know, I'm not going to yuck your yum. But at this point, wasn't there an alarm bell that went to you? This is effing crazy.
Absolutely. But keep in mind what I learned at the very beginning. If I feel uncomfortable and my alarm bells are going off, that means I'm doing it right. Mm-hmm. That's part of the indoctrination. And understand that this branding happened 12 years later from my first 5 days. So 12 years of indoctrination. I think everyone, while they may not understand cults or how somebody could let branding happen to them, everyone knows the metaphor of the frog in the water. If you put a frog in boiling water, it jumps out. If you heat it up slowly, they die because they don't feel the heat rising. And it's the same thing for people in cults. The ask is slow. It's a slow burn. If I joined my 5 day after meeting Mark and they said, could we put Keith Raniere's initials on your crotch? Of course I would have been like, are you crazy? There's no way. It doesn't happen like that. It happens over time. And the commitment that I had made to everyone in the community and the agreement that I would not turn away if I was uncomfortable only escalated. So the branding was presented to me as a tattoo. It was presented as a bonding ceremony with my sorority sisters. Like you said, it's not a big deal. Fraternities, we brand each other in this, you know, whatever. So I was going along with it under a certain pretense. The main thing, though, that I believed was to occur was that we were going to get a tattoo. And of course, it wasn't a tattoo, it was a brand. And at that point, I couldn't leave because they had this collateral, which they had also extracted from me under false pretenses, which was being used against me as a gun to the head. If you don't do this, this will be released.
Like the blackmail material.
They were blackmailing me, yes. And that was the basis of the investigation and the case, of which, of course, you now know Keith was convicted on all seven charges.
We'll talk more about the case in just a minute. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate you being willing to tell this story. I know that it's painful, and I know you've written a book about it, but that doesn't make it any less painful or ignominious. And I want to bring in a few more voices who can add some context to this kind of incredible but not unique story, and that will help us kind of get a little bit under the surface about how other kinds of cults work. Janja Lalich is a professor emeritus of sociology at Cal State Chico, who specializes in cults, coercion, and social control. She's the author of more than a half dozen books. Her latest is called Escaping Utopia. Professor Lalich, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Also joining us is Daniel Shaw, a psychoanalyst who works often with former cult members and their families, including several former members of NXIVM. Dan, glad to have you with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Professor Lalich, can we just start with a clear definition of what a cult is? I've heard people describe everything from being a Trump supporter to being in CrossFit as a cult. It's a term we kind of throw around too much. How do you define a cult?
Well, for me, I see a cult as a group or a social movement that has an authoritarian, charismatic leader who demands all loyalty and devotion. Secondly, there has to be some type of indoctrination program that requires people to change. And thirdly, there is generally some type of exploitation, either financially, sexually, physically. I think those are the three hallmark features.
Do you find, Professor, that cults tend to have some kind of a religious or spiritual bent, or do they really run the gamut?
They absolutely run the gamut. I think one of the myths is that all cults are religious, and that's not at all true. And we can see that in this example of Nexium, the cult that Sarah was in. I mean, it was a supposedly some type of self-help program. So cults absolutely run the gamut. And today, more than ever, they are kind of implanted in the professional world and the business world, which has sort of mainstreamed them and make them harder to recognize.
Dan, are cults illegal? I mean, how and when does the law get involved?
Well, you have to commit a crime. most of the cases that have been that I'm familiar with, there isn't an actual crime that can be brought to trial. Or even if there is, the victim is so frightened and ashamed that they don't want to take legal action. Also, many cults have a tremendous war chest, and the minute you want to try to take any kind of action, you'll be sued out of existence. I just want to acknowledge Sarah, an unusually brave cult survivor, because most, and I'm one myself, but most cult survivors will not go public in the way that Sarah has and others from Nexium have, so that cults are rarely taken to task the way Nexium has been. This is in large part due to your efforts, Sarah, so kudos to you.
Dan, I'd love to know more about some of the commonalities you hear among your clients. Let me play a quick voicemail from one of our listeners on the East Coast. Here's what Betsy left in our inbox.
My name is Betsy, and I'm calling from Kensington, Maryland. My sister joined the Lyndon LaRouche political cult in 1971. She later married another member and moved to Leesburg when LaRouche did. My parents did a lot to try to stay in contact, but even 48 years later, it's painful. There's nothing we can talk about. It's all conspiracy, and they know all the real stories. I lost my sister when she joined. She was and is smart, kind, funny, and gifted. All of that talent has been wasted, along with a lot of money. What cults do is convince the vulnerable that the world is broken and only they have the key to fix it. They make you feel good about your role while tearing you down. They control the narrative, keep their followers off balance, create a false sense of emergency, and an us-against-them environment.
Well, Betsy, thank you very much for sharing your story with us. Dan, any common bonds you hear among your clients' stories? Maybe part of Betsy's story sounds familiar?
It's all very familiar. The common bond typically is that people who get involved in these kinds of communities are eager to make some kind of a more meaningful contribution, as Sarah said earlier. They are creative people. They're people who feel their ambitions aren't being fulfilled as much as they could be, or that their idealism isn't being fulfilled as much as it could be. And so these communities offer sort of what looks like a very tangible way of developing your own talents and abilities to use for a greater good. That's one of the most common things. I think also people are vulnerable when they are exposed to cults. Very often, these are times of transition in people's lives. Perhaps they're feeling frustrated, disappointed, scared, anxious. I think these are experiences common to most human beings. And if at such a time in your life you happen to be invited to a program, as Sarah was, or you stumble upon a pamphlet somewhere and you say, oh, that looks interesting, you might find yourself getting recruited just because you accidentally fell into something at the right or maybe the wrong moment.
We're speaking to psychoanalyst Dan Shaw, the author of Traumatic Narcissism, Professor Emeritus John Yalalich of Cal State Chico, the author of Escaping Utopia, and Sarah Edmondson, author of Scarred, How I Escaped Nexium, the Cult That Bound My Life. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Professor Lalich, I want to play another message from a listener that gets to the kinds of people that cults target. Here's what Rachel left us using our app 1A Vox Pop.
When I was 19 years old, I joined an evangelical Christian cult in Texas and lived for 2 years in a walled compound with about 700 other people. I noticed that a lot of the people who joined the cult, like me, came from tough home situations. My mom had kicked me out when I was 16 years old, and I was looking for a family and a community, and I found it there. And even though it was a toxic environment and there was a lot of emotional recovery for me after the fact, I have a lot of strong relationships with people who also joined the cult and also got out that I have to this day. And it laid a foundation of discipline for me that without which I would not be where I am professionally. So I'll say that I took some positives from the experience, though I wouldn't recommend joining a cult. It does make a pretty good first date story.
Thanks very much, Rachel, for sharing your story with us. Professor, in your experience, who do cults typically target? Rachel mentioned a lot of her fellow members had had a hard life prior to joining the cult. Is that typical?
Well, that's typical for a certain segment of the population. But in general, cults look for people who can perform for them, who can run their businesses, who can bring in money, who can bring in other connections. You know, we always say they look for the best and the brightest, and that's really true. And I think that bright people are curious, as Dan was saying, and it leads them to want to do something better, and they fall into these things. And of course, cults also look for people with money, as Keith Raniere did, to be able to fund their operations. Just about anybody can be recruited at the right or wrong moment, again, as Dan said, but cults tend to want people who are physically well, mentally well. They don't want lazy people. They want people who can work for them. If someone's sick, they tend to just dump them off somewhere and get rid of them. So it's quite the opposite, I think, of what the general myth in society is.
Sarah, you were involved in some recruiting for Nexium, is that right?
Correct.
How did that go?
Well, I actually loved it at the time. I thought I was sharing what helped me, and I wanted other people to have the same experience I had. And I was, as Nexium kind of used me as a poster child for what recruitment could look like, because I had a big network of friends, and I was very passionate about it, as I am with anything that I like, whether it's a new celery juice is what I'm drinking now, for example. I talk about it, and people were drawn to that, and I was sort of like a magnet for the community, unfortunately, unwittingly supporting what we now know to be the true intentions of Keith.
And how successful were you as a recruiter?
I was a very successful recruiter. At one point, or a couple points in my tenure there, I was one of the top recruiters in the company. And acknowledged for that. Of course, they're very good at making you feel special and pumping you up to continue to do the good work that you're doing. And that was my main role there. I also taught some curriculum and ran the center in Vancouver. But recruiting was my main job at Nexium.
Were there any other kinds of significant roles that you had in what you described as the company, I guess what we would describe as the cult, but were there any other major roles that you played?
Well, I got to the level of green sash. So I was one of, I think, 12 green level executives in the program. And that meant that I could run my own center. So I ran the center in Vancouver and had my own little community of espions, as we called ourselves back then. Now we're expians.
Oh, espions who went to the ESP program and
correct.
People who used to be part who are ex-members of Nexium.
Yes.
I'm sure you are much happier to be an expian than an espian.
I am very happy to be an expian. Yeah, more than you know.
Definitely want to talk more about this as we continue with Sarah Edmondson, Professor Yanya Lalich, and Dan Shaw. Quite a few of you have sent in comments like what Robert wrote. Robert writes, 45, referring to the 45th President Donald Trump, 45 uses many cult tactics to manipulate blind followers. But Matt says bluntly, liberalism is a cult. How do we make sure this word isn't just thrown around for things we don't like? That's ahead. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Sarah Edmondson, Janya Lalich, and Dan Shaw. Plenty of your stories and comments coming in. Nick emailed, I was married to a woman who was mentally kidnapped by a couple. The man claimed to be talking to God, and my friends tell me he controls her like he is her master. She does everything he tells her to do. Her parents and friends and I haven't seen her for over 8 years. She has a master's degree in engineering. I have a hard time comprehending how someone so intelligent could be so psychologically manipulated. Professor Lalich, I wonder if you could respond to Nick, particularly that part at the end about someone so intelligent being psychologically manipulated.
Well, you know, cults use basic social psychology in the way that they influence and control people. And, you know, as I said earlier, intelligent people are absolutely prey to this kind of influence. I know it's always shocking to those of us on the outside who see someone, as he described, join something and become completely enamored with something. But it's as we were saying earlier, if they get you at that moment when you have some type of vulnerability and you see whatever this person is offering as some type of solution, and generally through whatever type of indoctrination they're doing, whatever type of, you know, influence and controls, as well as peer pressure. Peer pressure is a very important part of this. It's what keeps people doing what they need to do. It keeps people from questioning. And so someone can easily get involved in that kind of thing, and friends and relatives are often stymied. I think what he's describing, I don't know if there are more members than just her, but we often see these situations of one-on-one cults, or what I sometimes call family cults or the no-name cults. And again, they're much harder to distinguish because they often stay under the radar, and they don't get the attention that some of the larger cults that we know about do. And so it's not just that someone has to live on a compound. They can be involved in something. Your next door neighbor can be involved in something.
Dan, you've counseled the families of former cult members. Could you speak to what Nick described in terms of not having seen his wife in over 8 years? Are there any common bonds in terms of the social isolation, particularly from families, that many cults put their members through?
It's probably one of the most common things that will happen when somebody gets involved in a cult. The cult leader is a narcissist and needs more attention and more adoration than any normal human being ever should want or need. And because of that, the followers are meant to feel guilty and ashamed of any attachments that mean more to them than their attachment to the cult and the leader. And so there's a tremendous amount of estrangement from family and friends who are not involved that goes on in all cults. I just want to say that I define a cult, although I totally accept Janya's definition and have for many years. I think she's one of the best at defining cults. I define it as a group led by a traumatizing narcissist, somebody who needs adoration to a degree that is abnormal and who coerces others into providing that adoration. The coercion is, as Sarah has described, subtle and kind of gradual and accumulative, but it absolutely is coercive persuasion and very powerful, because the charisma of the leader, it involves a delusion of their own perfection, of their own superiority, and you get coerced into joining that delusion. So this is not easy to explain, but there is certainly family members experience tragic disconnection from people who get involved in these groups.
Well, Dan, what you described in terms of the leader might ring familiar to some folks with certain political leanings. We got a lot of comments about President Trump. Robert writes, 45, meaning the 45th president, Donald Trump, 45 uses many cult tactics to manipulate blind followers. Matt says bluntly, liberalism is a cult. Now, Dan, I don't know how you view this, but Does Donald Trump meet the description of a cult leader? Does his political movement count as a cult?
Yeah, you're not going to get me to commit myself on that. But what I
But you've described many of his personality traits, very narcissistic, constantly needing attention, builds a base over time. You know, he appeared in public. He was written about in Time magazine, and then he was on The Apprentice, and then he accused Barack Obama of not being American, and then he ran for president. I mean, right. A lot of what you said matches his history.
Right. Well, draw your own conclusions. that would be how I'd answer that. I think what our job is to what I assigned myself the job of was figuring out the personality the personal psychology of a cult leader. I was in a cultic group for 13 years, very, very committed. And when I left, I began my graduate degree in social work and my psychoanalytic training, and that's when I became fascinated with understanding not just me. I knew my own vulnerabilities. I wanted to know, why is a person like that proclaiming to be so generous and helpful and transformative? Why are they also so cruel and sadistic? What's going on? And so, you know, basically I have a theory, and we can describe these behaviors, but I can't diagnose or diagnose somebody from afar. I can tell you what the behaviors are and where they come from, and I have to leave it there.
John Spencer writes, the only true difference between what we call a cult and what we call an organized religion is the passage of time. It only takes about two generations for any cult to change from proselytizing to self-preservation. That path is paved by money. Professor Lalich, we got a number of comments about religions, including from Cassandra, who emailed, I was one of the Jehovah's Witnesses for over 20 years. It was one of the hardest things I ever did to leave. My question, while I personally consider Jehovah's Witnesses a cult, would your experts qualify it as such? Professor, we've had a few Jehovah's Witnesses reach out and share similar thoughts. How do you see it?
Well, I have no qualms about identifying Jehovah's Witnesses as a cult. They have secretiveness. They have a history of child sexual abuse that they've tried to brush under the rug. You know, right now we see dozens of lawsuits regarding that. But I want to talk about religion per se. The difference between a cult and a healthy religion is that a healthy religion is going to have you worshiping or praying to some kind of higher being, whether that's God or Allah or a tree or, you know, whatever it might be. They're not having you worship the living person, the pastor, the preacher, the priest in front of you. When you're in a religious organization that's expecting you to do that, then you're not in a healthy religious group. So,
but then we kind of get back to John's comment about the passage of time. I mean, by that definition, Jesus and his disciples could have been considered a cult to the Jews of his day.
Yes, he could. Absolutely. So, for some groups, the passage of time may lead to them shedding some of their more extreme behaviors and beliefs. It may lead to becoming more mainstream. I believe we saw that, you know, with the Mormon church.
I think we might have dropped our connection to the professor. We'll work on getting that back as we read a few more comments from our listeners. Lord of Logic tweets, never forget Philip Zimbardo conducted the prison experiment without ever locking a single door. Everybody in that group was assigned a role and embraced the part as if it was reality. He's referring to the Stanford prison experiment where some volunteers were assigned to be guards, others were assigned to be prisoners, and the guards were so abusive to the prisoners that the whole experiment had to be shut down. Sarah, I wonder how you would react to that in terms of just the power of the group to make you maybe do things you never thought you would.
Great question. Ironically, Keith showed us the Stanford prison experiment in one of our curriculums, and I think that he was doing what we now know he does often, which is teaching us about something while he's doing it to us. And I think his whole program, Nexium, and then later the men's group and the women's group were his own version of that experiment, saying, let's give these people roles. I'm going to give you the role of master, you the role of slave, and let's see what happens. See how far I can take this.
If
And I absolutely think that as brilliant as he is, and he is in a terrible way, he misjudged the role that he gave me because he certainly messed with the wrong person.
I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. I'd love to know, Sarah, what it was like for you kind of rebuilding your life after going through this cult. I imagine there were certain ties that you had to break, certain things you were accustomed to, maybe even some benefits that you perceived you got from NXIVM. How did you go about kind of realigning your life without that group?
It was very difficult for me to leave the community. That was the hardest thing when I decided to cut ties. This is even before I decided to go public, when I knew that I couldn't be a part of this anymore. I had been so enmeshed with these people and the community that I had built in Vancouver as well. But I deprogrammed very quickly, all because my one belief that Keith was great or in a religious cult, that a belief in a certain God or a higher power, when I suddenly realized that Keith was not who he said he was, in fact, that he was a liar and he was the complete opposite, perhaps evil or the darkest person I'd ever encountered. When that belief switched, everything else fell apart. Everything else crumbled. And it took me some time to, it was actually Dan Shaw specifically who helped me look at, okay, what am I throwing out here and what do I want to keep? Because truthfully, in my 12 years of being there, I did learn a lot and I did overcome a lot of my own personal limitations and beliefs that were in my way of being a more optimal person and a happier person, less anxious and so forth. So I had to really root through the ashes and say, okay, what tool is this? And how I was able to reclaim it is to figure out where it came from originally, because I used to pay tribute to Keith for all of these things and say, oh, you know, this is a tool from this method or this methodology, and then I could reclaim it as my own so I didn't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
And Dan, before we have to wind down, what advice would you have either for people who are trapped in a cult and want to get out, or people whose loved ones are trapped and want to help them?
Yeah, well, the people who are in the cult and want to get out are hard to help. They have got to ask for help before you can go in and pull them out. Often those kinds of interventions backfire. For families who are losing somebody to a cult, this is a tragic circumstance, and there is no easy solution. Interventions can work, and there are very skilled interventionists who are good at doing this, but they don't always work. It's always a gamble. What you can do if you're not going to intervene is keep the bridges open. Do not burn the bridge. And let the person in the group know you're there, you love them, you have faith in them, and hold tight to that. It may take a while, but that bridge is open for them, and if they want to leave, they know it's there.
Dan Shaw, psychoanalyst. His book is called Traumatic Narcissism. Dan, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Janja Lalic, professor emeritus at Cal State Chico. Her latest book is called Escaping Utopia. Professor Lalic, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Sarah Edmondson, her new book is called Scarred, How I Escaped NXIVM, the Cult That Bound My Life. Sarah, we appreciate you telling your story. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Before we go, it feels right to say a few words about Cokie Roberts. As you may have heard at the top of the hour, she died today after a fight with breast cancer at the age of 75. She joined NPR in 1978 and leaves a lasting mark on our business with her coverage of Washington politics both here and at ABC News. She was a best-selling author, an Emmy Award winner, the child of two members of Congress. Her father was the Democratic leader in the House for decades, disappeared in the early 70s, and then her mother took her father's seat and held it for a number of years. She was also a pioneer, one of the founding mothers of NPR, alongside Nina Totenberg, Linda Wertheimer, and Susan Stanberg. Cokie shaped NPR sound and its culture at a time when very few women held prominent roles in journalism. Here's Cokie responding to one listener last year who asked whether 2018 was living up to its billing as the year of the woman.
Well, this is painful for me, Steve, since I was one of the reporters always declaring the year of the woman when it wasn't. But 1984, we thought might be a year of the women. 1990, we thought might be a year of the women. But 92 actually was. And more women were elected than in any decade before that. 24 to the House, the number in the Senate tripled. Also, it was the beginning of minority women's representation in large numbers. 47 of the 58 minority women now serving in Congress were elected between 1992 and 2016.
That was Cokie Roberts speaking last year, answering the question about whether last year was the year of the woman. Rachel Martin from Morning Edition speaks for many of us, saying, "We are heartbroken. When I was at high school, I wanted to grow up to be Cokie Roberts. We will miss her so very much." And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has released a statement calling the passing of Cokie Roberts, quote, "a great official loss for our nation and a deep personal loss for all who were blessed to call Cokie a friend." Today's show was produced by Paige Osborne. You can learn more about her and the rest of our team at the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you, Cokie Roberts, for all you did to pave the way for us. This is 1A.